Our history is often told through the lens of divine intervention or accidental rage. We are taught that the Haitian Revolution was a sudden explosion of long repressed anger, but anger is a fire that burns out once the fuel is gone. Anger does not defeat three global empires. To understand how the enslaved took the richest colony on earth and turned it into a sovereign nation, we must look past the myth of the vengeful ghost. We must look at the man who treated the revolution like a game of chess played on a board made of blood and sugar. Toussaint Louverture was not a creature of impulse. He was a man of the system who learned how to break it from the inside. He watched, he waited, he calculated. By the time the world realized who he was, he had already moved the pieces into place for their inevitable checkmate. The Breda plantation was not a place of chaotic cruelty. It was a factory. It was a high-output machine designed to turn human life into white gold. In 1743, a boy named Toussaint was born into this machinery. Most men in his position were broken by the age of 20. They died from exhaustion or the lash. Toussaint did not break. He was small and thin, earning him the nickname of the scrawny stick. But he possessed a clarity of mind that the overseers could not quantify. He was given a rare commodity on a sugar estate, time. He was a coachman and a livestock healer. He traveled between the fields and the big house. He saw the mechanics of colonial power. He saw how the French relied on the very people they claimed were subhuman. Toussaint was literate. He read the classics. He read the military treatises of the Enlightenment. He did not just read for pleasure. He read to understand the mind of his enemy. While the world saw a quiet, aging black man tending to horses, Toussaint was mapping the terrain of Saint-Domingue. He knew every ravine and every mountain pass. He knew the temperaments of the white planters and the frustrations of the free people of color. By the time he was in his 30s, he was a free man. This is a fact often buried in the legend. Toussaint Louverture had a small plot of land. He had his own enslaved workers. He had a taste of the life the masters lived. He was not a man with nothing to lose. He was a man who understood exactly what was at stake. In August 1791, the north of the island went up in flames. The ceremony at Boishaiman had signaled the end of the old world. Thousands of enslaved people rose up with machetes and torches. They burned the cane. They killed the masters who had tortured them for generations. It was a tide of righteous fury. Toussaint did not join them immediately. He did not run into the fire with a cry for vengeance. He stayed at Breda. He protected his former masters. He ensured his family was safe. This was not out of a lingering love for the plantation system. It was a calculation. He knew that an unorganized rebellion would be crushed by the first disciplined regiment sent from Europe. He waited until the chaos had a shape. When he finally entered the camps of the rebels, he did not come as a foot soldier. He came as a doctor and an advisor. He saw the leaders of the early revolt, men like Biassou and Jean-François, struggling to maintain order. They had the numbers, but they lacked the structure. Toussaint began to build that structure. He took men who had known only the whip and taught them the manual of arms. He showed them how to move as a unit. He understood that to win a war against France, his men had to become more than rebels. They had to become a professional army. He spent his own money to buy weapons. He used his knowledge of the land to create a network of intelligence that the French could not penetrate. The world began to change around him. The French Revolution had decapitated a king in Paris, and the shockwaves were hitting the Caribbean. The white colonists were divided between those loyal to the crown and those who wanted a new republic. The Spanish in Santo Domingo saw an opportunity to seize the French side of the island. The British were lurking in the waters, waiting to claim the sugar production for themselves. It was a landscape of shifting sands. Most men would have picked a side and stayed there. Toussaint saw three empires in conflict and realized he could play them against each other. He was not loyal to the Spanish king or the French Republic. He was loyal to the goal of ending the system of slavery forever. He took the name Louverture, the opening. Some say it was because he could find a gap in any enemy line. Others say it was his way of announcing that the door to the old world was being kicked off its hinges. He led his troops with a cold, terrifying discipline. He didn't allow his soldiers to loot or commit senseless acts of violence. He wanted the world to see a black army that was more civilized than the white armies trying to enslave them. He used the Spanish for supplies and rank, rising to the position of general in their service. He used their muskets to sharpen his men. He was building a force that the world had never seen. By 1794, the political winds shifted again. The French Republic, desperate to keep the colony and under pressure from the rebellion, abolished slavery. This was the moment Toussaint had calculated for. He did not hesitate. He abandoned his Spanish allies and brought his disciplined army back under the French flag. It was a masterstroke. In a single move, he had gained legal legitimacy for the end of slavery and placed himself at the head of the only military force on the island that mattered. He began to drive the Spanish back. He began to hem in the British who had landed on the coast. He was now the most powerful man in Saint-Domingue, but he was surrounded by enemies who looked like allies. The French officials sent from Paris wanted to regain control. The white planters wanted their property back. The free people of color in the south feared his rising influence. Toussaint ignored the noise. He focused on the math of power. He knew that the only thing keeping the French from reinstating slavery was the fact that they needed him to fight the British. He made himself indispensable. He became the wall between France and the loss of their most valuable colony. But even a wall can be bypassed if the foundation is weak. Toussaint began to look toward the south, where André Rigaud held sway. Rigaud was a man of color, educated and elite, who viewed Toussaint and his army of former slaves with suspicion. The island was not big enough for two leaders. The peace was a thin veil over a brewing civil war. Toussaint knew that to secure the future, he would have to turn his guns on his own people. He began to mobilize his forces, moving them toward the border of Rigaud's territory, with the precision of a man who had already envisioned the end of the conflict. The British were still dug into the coastal fortresses, dying of yellow fever, but refusing to leave. The French were watching from across the Atlantic, their letters becoming more frequent and more demanding. Toussaint sat in his headquarters, reading reports by candlelight. He was 50 years old, an age when most men in the Caribbean were considered ancient. He was just getting started. He had outlived the masters of Breda. He had outplayed the Spanish generals. Now, he was preparing to face the man who would eventually become his greatest shadow. The shadow was not a person, but a realization. Toussaint Louverture knew that the freedom he had won was only as strong as the army that defended it. And to keep that army fed, the plantations had to produce. To produce, the people had to work. The very system he had fought to destroy was the only tool he had to build a nation. He began to draft new laws, laws that looked disturbingly like the ones he had torn down. As the sun rose over the mountains of the north, the sound of marching feet replaced the sound of the drums. The first test of his absolute authority was coming, and it would not come from a foreign king. The shift from rebel leader to head of state was not a change in character, it was a change in scale. Toussaint Louverture understood that a revolution without an economy is just a slow-motion suicide. He looked at the scorched earth of Saint-Domingue and saw a ledger that needed to be balanced. The British had been expelled and the Spanish were neutralized. Now the internal fractures of the island began to leak. In the south, André Rigaud and the mulatto elite held a separate power base. They saw Toussaint as a threat to their status. Toussaint saw them as a threat to a unified defense. The War of the Knives broke out in 1799. It was a brutal, intimate conflict. This was not a war of grand maneuvers on open plains. It was a war of ambushes in the mountains and executions in the streets. Toussaint's second-in-command, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, carried out the campaign with a ferocity that Toussaint allowed but did not personally claim. They crushed Rigaud's forces. By 1800, the South was brought to heel. Toussaint was now the undisputed master of the island. He did not celebrate. He went back to the paperwork. He knew the French were watching. Napoleon Bonaparte had seized power in Paris. Napoleon was a man of the same mold as Toussaint, a strategist, a pragmatist, and a man who believed in the absolute necessity of order. But Napoleon saw the Caribbean as a resource to be harvested, not a partner to be respected. Toussaint anticipated the collision. To preempt it, he did something unthinkable. In 1801, without the permission of the French government, he overran the eastern side of the island, the former Spanish colony of Santo Domingo. He did it to ensure no foreign power could use the eastern ports to land an invasion force. With the entire island under his boot, he moved to codify his power. He gathered a committee of white planters and wealthy men of color to draft a constitution. It was a document of radical contradictions. It abolished slavery forever, declaring all men born in the colony to be French and free, but it also named Toussaint Louverture governor general for life. It gave him the power to choose his successor. It turned Saint-Domingue into a sovereign state in everything but name. He sent a copy to Napoleon with a note that was polite, but carried the weight of a threat. He was telling Paris that the island was his. Toussaint's biggest gamble was the labor code. He knew that if the sugar and coffee exports stopped, his army would starve and the French would have a moral excuse to return. He instituted a system called caporalisme. The former slaves were forced back into the fields. They were no longer owned by individuals, but they were tied to the plantations. They were paid a portion of the crops, but they could not leave without permission. To the people who had fought for freedom, it felt like a new mask on an old ghost. Toussaint believed this was the only way to fund the defense of their liberty. He traded the short-term happiness of his people for the long-term survival of the black state. The tension in the air was thick. The people were working under the sun again, and the whip had been replaced by the bayonet of Toussaint's own soldiers. Toussaint himself moved constantly. He slept only a few hours a night. He rode his horses until they collapsed. He was everywhere at once, inspecting fortifications, checking ledgers, and watching the horizon. He was waiting for the answer from France. He knew Napoleon would not accept a subordinate who acted like a king. He began to stockpile grain. He moved cannons into the high mountain fortresses. In Paris, Napoleon was indeed furious. He saw Toussaint as a gilded African who had dared to challenge the French Empire. He began to assemble the largest expeditionary force France had ever sent across the Atlantic. Tens of thousands of veteran soldiers, the same men who had conquered Europe, were packed into ships. They were led by Charles Leclerc, Napoleon's brother-in-law. Their secret instructions were clear: land, disarm the black population, arrest the leaders, and restore the old regime. Slavery was to be reinstated once the smoke cleared. Toussaint's intelligence network told him the fleet was coming. He did not panic. He had prepared the ground. He told his generals that if the French landed, they were to burn the cities to the ground. They were to retreat into the mountains and let the climate do the fighting. He knew that the European soldiers would melt away under the tropical sun and the yellow fever. He was prepared to turn the entire island into a graveyard if it meant keeping the French from taking it back. In February 1802, the horizon filled with French sails. Dozens of ships carrying the might of the Napoleonic machine arrived at the ports. Leclerc sent a message demanding surrender. Toussaint's response was silence. In the city of Le Cap, General Henri Christophe followed Toussaint's orders. As the French moved to land, he set fire to his own palace. The flames rose hundreds of feet into the air. The most beautiful city in the Caribbean was reduced to ash in a single night. The war had begun. It was no longer a rebellion. It was a clash of civilizations. The French were shocked by the discipline of the black troops. They expected a rabble. They found a wall of fire. But the French had the numbers and the naval support. They began to push inland, taking the coastal towns one by one. Toussaint retreated into the interior, drawing them deeper into the trap. He was playing for time. Every day the French spent in the heat was a day they lost men to disease. But the pressure was mounting. Some of Toussaint's own generals began to defect. They saw the size of the French fleet and believed the cause was lost. They were offered ranks and safety by the French. Toussaint watched as his circle of trust began to shrink. He remained cold. He remained focused. He was waiting for the rainy season. He was waiting for the fever. He was waiting for the moment when the French would be weak enough for a single decisive blow. The conflict centered on a small fortress in the mountains called Crête-Pierrot. It was a strategic point that commanded the valley. If the French took it, they could break the back of the resistance. Toussaint left the defense to his most loyal men and moved into the hills to coordinate the wider war. The siege that followed would become a legend of grit and blood. But for Toussaint, it was simply another variable in the equation of survival. As the French cannons began to batter the walls of the fort, Toussaint received a letter. It was an invitation to a meeting to discuss a peace treaty. The French claimed they wanted to end the bloodshed. They promised to respect the ranks of his officers. They promised that slavery would not return. Toussaint knew the history of French promises. He knew the risk of walking into the enemy camp. But he also saw his army tiring and his resources thinning. He stood on a ridge, looking down at the smoke rising from the valley. He had to decide if he was a general who would fight to the last man, or a politician who could negotiate a future from the wreckage. He turned his horse toward the French lines, unaware that the trap was already closing. The siege at Crêtepierrot was a slaughterhouse. For weeks, a few hundred of Toussaint's men held off thousands of French regulars. When the defenders finally ran out of water and ammunition, they didn't surrender. They cut their way through the French lines and vanished into the night. It was a tactical defeat, but a psychological victory. The French were bleeding out. By May 1802, Leclerc's army was losing dozens of men a day to yellow fever. The hospitals were overflowing. The French general needed a pause to regroup. He offered a ceasefire. Toussaint saw the exhaustion of his own troops. He agreed to lay down his arms on one condition. His officers would retain their ranks, and his men would remain free. He retired to his plantation at Ennery. He lived quietly, but he was never off the clock. He spent his days watching the French movements. He knew they were waiting for the fever to break before they made their move to restore slavery. He was writing letters to his generals in code. He was preparing for the next phase of the war. He was a tiger waiting in the tall grass. The French were terrified of him. Even in retirement, Toussaint was the center of gravity for the entire island. Leclerc realized that as long as the old Toussaint was alive and on the island, the French could never truly control the colony. A plan was hatched in June 1802. General Brunet invited Toussaint to a meeting to discuss administrative matters. Toussaint's advisors warned him it was a trap. He went anyway. Some say he was tired. Others say he believed his own status as a French general would protect him. He entered Brunet's house with a small escort. Within minutes, he was surrounded by soldiers with fixed bayonets. He was stripped of his sword. He was bound like a common criminal. As they led him to the coast to be put on a ship, he turned to his captors. He told them that in overrowing him, they had only cut down the trunk of the Tree of Liberty. He warned them that the roots were deep and numerous. He was placed on the ship Le Héros. He would never see the soil of Saint-Domingue again. He was transported across the Atlantic in a cramped cabin, denied the dignity of his rank. He was no longer a governor. He was a prisoner of state. Napoleon did not want a public trial. He did not want a martyr. He wanted Toussaint to disappear. He ordered him sent to Fort de Joux, a cold, damp fortress, high in the Jura Mountains near the Swiss border. It was the opposite of the Caribbean. It was a place of grey stone and eternal winter. Toussaint was placed in a cell with a small window that let in the freezing mountain air. They took his watch. They took his uniform. They gave him only the barest necessities. Napoleon's agents interrogated him, demanding to know where he had hidden his gold. Toussaint gave them nothing. He spent his time writing long detailed letters to Napoleon, defending his actions and demanding justice. Napoleon never replied. While Toussaint withered in the cold, his prophecy back home was coming true. The French finally dropped the mask. Word reached the island that slavery had been restored in other French colonies like Guadeloupe. The black generals who had defected to the French, including Dessalines and Christophe, realized they were next. They turned on Leclerc. The war reignited with a savagery that made the previous battles look like skirmishes. The roots of the tree were indeed deep. The people knew that if they lost, they would be returned to the chain. They fought with the desperation of the damned. In the mountains of France, the winter of 1802 was brutal. Toussaint's health failed. He had spent his life in the heat of the tropics, and the mountain dampness turned his lungs to glass. He developed a deep, racking cough. His cell was kept intentionally cold. The commandant of the fort reduced his rations. Toussaint sat in his chair, wrapped in a thin blanket, staring at the stone walls. He was a man of logic and calculation, who had finally run out of moves. On April 7, 1803, the guards found him dead in his chair. He was 60 years old. The news of his death did not reach Saint-Domingue for months. It didn't matter. The machine he had built was already in motion. Jean-Jacques Dessalines had taken the lead, and he did not share Toussaint's penchant for diplomacy. Dessalines understood that the only way to secure the future was to finish what Toussaint had started. He drove the French into the sea. In November 1803, the French surrendered. On January 1st, 1804, the independent nation of Haiti was declared. It was the first black republic in the world. It was the only successful slave revolution in human history. Toussaint Louverture died in a cold cell, thousands of miles from the land he had liberated. His body was thrown into an unmarked grave under the floor of the chapel at Fort de Joux. The French thought they had erased him. They were wrong. His legacy was not in a tomb, but in the existence of a nation that refused to be owned. He had shown the world that the enslaved were not just capable of rebellion, but of governance and high strategy. He had outthought the greatest minds of his age. Our history honors the warrior, but we must remember the manager. Toussaint Louverture was the architect of a miracle. He took a broken people and gave them the structure to defeat an empire. He proved that freedom is not a gift given by the master, but a position seized through relentless calculation. The cost of his strategy was high, and the scars on the Haitian soul are still visible today. But without his cold, steady hand on the wheel, the ship of the revolution would have crashed against the rocks long before it reached the shore. The white gold of the sugar fields was gone, replaced by the red blood of the struggle. The world would never be the same. The empires of Europe trembled because they knew that if it could happen in Saint-Domingue, it could happen anywhere. Toussaint was gone, but the opening he created would never be closed.